His readers were horrified to learn on July 3rd that the subject of his new series was his own heart attack. Late one night in June, he was awakened by a pain in his chest. It was hard for him to tell if it was indigestion, something a good burp would cure, or a heart attack. Like many others who have been awakened with that pain, he didn't know if he should call for an ambulance or drink seltzer. Ironically, after taking the trolley to the emergency room, Drake became a patient in the same coronary unit that he was writing an article about. Today at 4, Donald Drake, who is feeling better and is back at work at the Enquirer, will talk with us about his response to his heart attack and the doctor's response to him. We'll also discuss some of the other medical subjects that he's written about. Every Tuesday at 3:30 on Fresh Air, we feature Jazz Revisited, a survey of recorded jazz from 1917 to 1947. Today, host Hazen Schumacher features alternate takes by Eddie Condon and the New Orleans Rhythm Kings. If you spent any time during the summer camping out or in a country home, you may have had the opportunity to reflect on the design of an outhouse. In 1929, one of the best-selling books in America was called The Specialist. Written by Chick Sales, a vaudeville comedian, this was a comic look at an outhouse builder. Well, today at 3 o'clock, Charles Hardy continues the popular culture series with some reflections on the privy's place in American culture and a look at Chick Sales and The Specialist. With me now on Fresh Air are Ruth, June, and Anita Poynter, known collectively as the Poynter Sisters. In the early 70s, the group became known for their harmonies and melodies influenced by jazz of the 1930s and 40s. Their performing clothes matched their music and the period they reflected. But the Poynter Sisters have since stepped out of that period into current dance rhythms. Their new album, Special Things, was produced by Richard Perry, a producer whose other hits that he produced include Carly Simon's You're So Vain. The Poynter Sisters, I'm happy to say, are in Philadelphia. They're performing now at the Burgundy Room in the Fairmont Hotel. Before we meet them and before we hear some selections from their new album, let's listen to a song from their first hit album. This is a song of their own. It's called Sugar.
Sugar. Sugar might go astray, but he always comes back to his honey baby. Sugar, sugar, people think that I'm just wasting my time just because I keep him on my mind. And they talk and tease and tell me tales, but don't you know they're lying?
Sugar,
sugar,
sugar.
Won't you pass the sugar, please? Hey, Papa, no matter where you go, you're a real showstopper.
The man who gave me sugar way down in my soul. And every time I kiss him, I just lose control.
Sugar.
Don't take my sugar away.
Sugar, written and performed by the Poynter Sisters, who are my guests in the studio. They're in Philadelphia to play the Burgundy Room in the Fairmont Hotel. Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air. It's a real treat to have you here.
Thank you.
I know that you haven't listened to that in a long time. Many of our listeners are probably were first acquainted through your music through the early records, which were and feel like the one we just heard. How did you first get into that sound, the very jazz-influenced sound of the 30s and the 40s?
I think harmonies had a lot to do with that sound, and we harmonized because everybody wanted to sing and everybody wanted to be heard, So you couldn't sing unison and hear yourself. So we kind of harmonized through everything in the beginning, you know.
Was it a music that was played in your house?
No.
Did you grow up with it?
No. And the clothes that we were wearing had something to do with it, too. We kind of went to thrift stores, you know, for shopping. And so that had a part in it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that your parents were both ministers.
Right.
Yeah.
Did that affect the kind of music that you did or did not get to hear?
Probably, oh, yes. Because contemporary, like rock and roll in those days, we weren't allowed to have played in the house. Elvis Presley and whoever was back then, I don't remember because I couldn't hear them. Blues and rhythm and blues, we didn't listen to a lot of it. It was mostly church music and other music like from television cartoons or advertisements for products on the radio or something like that.
Were you angry when you found out what you were missing?
No.
No, not angry. Just wanted to start listening to it then.
Is it hard to start performing in what's almost a musical vacuum because you haven't been in touch with the other music that's been happening around you?
For some reason, we seem to have been in touch, you know.
Yeah, I think
naturally.
I think it was we were born with the rhythm already there, you know, because we were singing as babies. We sang in my father's church, and we were called the Pointer Sisters there, and Ruth played the piano, and we harmonized, and I never took singing lessons at all, so I think I was just born with something, you know.
I'm sure that different audiences reacted to you for different reasons. For some people, you were doing the music that they remembered when they grew up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For others, you were an introduction to mm-hmm. a period of music that they missed. And others just, I'm sure, just didn't care when it was from or what you were
right.
influenced by, but just dug it.
Right.
Were you ever surprised by the reactions that you got from your listeners when you first started really having a devoted following?
Oh,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah,
really
we
surprised.
Were shocked. I mean, really.
God.
Even things like the song Sugar and Jada and Shaky Flat Blues, songs that we wrote, that were so much like the old songs. And we had no idea. To us, they were just good, fun songs.
We
weren't rock and roll. They weren't blues. They were just
right.
good, fun songs. And I was surprised that people liked them.
Really?
You know, because they were like our own little private songs. We always made up little songs and
really?
Sang them with each other.
Really?
And I didn't think anybody
right.
would want to hear
Even
them,
about
but
nursery rhymes, we would make up little rhythms and sing nursery rhymes
mm-hmm.
to a 40-ish, you know, music background
yeah.
and street songs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a
really?
Big surprise to us. Mm-hmm. God.
Everybody has an act when they're a kid. I won't go into that.
Come on. Let's
sing that. What did you do? Come on.
No, I used to sing in front of the mirror, and you know.
Oh,
but I think everybody does
that,
right?
Yeah.
What was your image of yourself then? How did you see yourself when you were kids in front of the mirror doing your act?
To me, it's kind of like television, one thing. We were able to watch certain shows on television, and when Mother and Dad would leave, we would get out in the hallway, and we'd tuck up our dresses and play like we were ballerinas.
Right.
You know, so this is showbiz, just, you know.
Play the tambourine with a pie pan, bang on the table for a piano, you know.
It's I think, very difficult to figure out how to break into the music industry. No matter how talented you are, the first thing you have to do is get heard by the right people.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the things that you tried to do in order to meet the right people and get heard by the right people and break in?
Everything that came to mind.
You
I
try
mean,
to
not any one thing.
Get there to hear them. You try to get, you know, like we were living in Oakland at the time. We started out, and most of the work was in San Francisco, and we didn't have any cars or, you know, transportation. My mother and father definitely were going to take us over there and drop us off. You know?
Right.
So we would hitchhike over there and to L.A., to wherever we could had to go to sing, you know, just to jam with groups, to be heard.
Be at the right place.
And
hopefully at the right time.
Yeah.
What worked finally? What were some of those moments that
San
helped?
Francisco, I think, was the turning point because
and
it happened
Angeles.
Right exactly during the rock acid.
Right.
When Janis
Fillmore
and Fillmore West,
and
Fillmore East, Winterland were just bursting wide open with performers. And Bonnie and June started hanging out with musicians and ended up on stage a few times, just couldn't resist the opportunity to be up there when somebody called them because they would be having a fit in the audience, you know. And I think that's where it all started, really, just being there.
Looking back on it now, what are some of the things that you think you were really naive about as far as what it takes to make it in music and what it's like when you make it?
I think our talent we've been pretty naive with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
You know,
we didn't really know what we could do until we started doing things, and then it's like, God, what are we doing all this?
Also, we didn't realize it was a gift or a special thing as it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that everybody can't sing Salt Peanuts. That was, to us for so long, I mean, it was just so natural. We felt that anybody could do what we're doing. You know, it's mm-hmm. nothing really that special, but
right.
I'm beginning to realize that it is something that we should really treasure.
Right.
Did you know what to do when you started getting recording contracts and things like that? Because I think for a young artist who's really trying to make any offer is terrific.
Right,
and maybe
right.
the last thing on your mind is if you should actually even
I've
be
never
getting
seen
more.
A contract in my life. Are you kidding?
No.
My father was a country reverend, and my mom was from Arkansas. So, and what I knew about a contract was television or something, you know, something way out of my...
Well, I had seen contracts. I had been working in an attorney's office before I started singing, but I read the contracts, I understood what they were, but I knew that I only had so much power or so much to do with what was going to happen. You know, I had to give so much of myself and give up and humble and, you know, just let them take charge for now until I had the monetary backing to do what I wanted to do.
Looking back, Anita, do you think you made the right decisions about things?
Mm-hmm. I think we did. We made the right decisions. You know, there's been very few wrong ones. You know, you will make a few, but I think the right ones have outweighed all the wrong decisions we've made.
They sure have.
I think television was one of the really helpful things in getting your music exposed to mm-hmm. people. What was it like for you those
that
first few times when you were on TV?
That was funny. I mean, I guess another thing is we didn't realize people wanted to watch us the way they do. I used to really get mad because we would be walking down the street, dressed kind of weird maybe, but people would stare at us and stare. I mean, and I didn't feel that different from anybody else. I knew we were always taller than most women or most girls that we were around, but it used to kind of bother me sometimes the way people stared at us like we were something really out of the ordinary. And come to find out, I guess we are. Because, I mean, the first show we ever did at the Troubadour, Jeff Wald came down and just snatched us right up for Helen Reddy's summer replacement show for Flip Wilson. And it was so fast, it was like, are they serious or what is this? You know?
TV.
You gotta be kidding. We gotta come down here every weekend and do this? And it was true, and it just kept getting more and more and more. People wanted us on this show. And
all the magazines, I couldn't believe
it. It was great. It was great experience, really.
Did you ever get any really libelous publicity, any of those star-type magazines that tend to make up a lot
like
of
like Esquire
things
and
people?
Star.
I don't know. We might have.
I don't really read
I don't keep up
stuff.
With all the,
you probably
know,
did at
that
during those days.
Probably.
I'm sure.
Just can't even keep up with the publicity.
That reviewed us at the Roxy. That's the only one I really remember who said that we perspire in all the wrong places.
What are the right places?
But things like, I don't
know. Well, we're going to hear some of your fairly recent work, and then we'll hear something from your new album. Now, your approach to the music has changed. You've, although you're still doing in your live performances, as you're doing here in Philadelphia, music that is like inspired from the 1930s and 1940s, mm-hmm. you've changed your sound quite a bit. What led to that change?
Time, yeah.
Really? Yeah. I guess just time did it because we didn't plan it.
And then we've always said that we didn't want to be stagnated in one, you know, place.
Yeah.
It's like we wanted to make it a challenge to us to, you know, express variety and, you know, try different things and see if people like different things about us.
Was that hard to do? Did your fans resist the change?
No, it wasn't nearly as even hard as I was probably kind of frightened at first about what the audience would think. But as long as it was good quality, I didn't feel like they would reject it at all, and they didn't.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk a little bit about what it's like to put together a record and some of the decisions that you have to make when you're recording it. But first, let's listen to a selection from an album called Pointer Sisters. And this is a song that's written by Bruce Springsteen. It's called The Fever. And do you want to say anything about this recording before we hear it?
No. Not particularly. I like the song a lot, and we've done it a lot in the live show. It's a little different live, but I like it a lot.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
When I get home from my job, I turn on the TV, but I can't keep my mind on the show. When I lay down at night, I don't get no sleep, so I turn on the radio. Day. I've got a fever for this guy.
She's got the fever. Oh, she's got the fever.
Nothing a girl can do.
She's got a fever for this guy. She's got the fever. Oh, she's got the fever.
Left this little girl blue. I can remember you coming home. See me standing at the stove with the dishes on the table, dinner ready to go. Or maybe out to a movie show. Something that you'd like to see. About it makes me feel all right. All my days are getting longer, my love keeps getting stronger, and the fever gets so bad at night. When I lay down at night,
mother used to say, my days are getting longer and my love keep getting stronger. The fever is worse day by day.
Pointer Sisters singing The Fever, and the Pointer Sisters are my guests in the studio. They're in Philadelphia performing at the Burgundy Room in the Fairmont Hotel. And in a few minutes, we'll be hearing a selection from their new record. Let's talk a little bit about what it's like to put together a record. Say it's time, you know, you're going to go back to the studio, you're going to do another record. I guess one of the first things you have to do is hook up with a producer. You've worked with different producers. How important is it, the producer who you have, in terms of what the album is going to sound like finally?
Well, the Pointer Sisters, and well, we've been recording for 8 years now, and there's only been two producers, David Rubinson and now Richard Perry. So when we get ready to record, we know where we're going or who we're going to, and all year you're collecting material, right. And it's just getting together with, you know, whoever is working with you and collaborating on what you like and which would work best and why, and narrowing the list down.
How do you choose the songs?
We usually just, a group of us, the producer, the three of us, and whoever else is helping us to find material, sit around and listen to tapes or demos that have been sent in from publishing companies or from other writers in the company or things that we've written on a tape recorder and just pick out what catches our ear for what the album is going to say.
Do you usually agree on what's going to work for an album?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I don't. And, you know, it's like, I really have to like the song to record it, because it's like raw meat when you go in that studio, and anything that is out there in the air that is feeling uncomfortable or unsure of, I can hear it, and I wouldn't want anybody else to hear that. So it's like I have to
I can
eat
hear that.
Also. No.
Well, when's you're hungry, I think you're trying to.
My stomach is growling. Okay.
Once you've got the song selected, you also have to figure out what kind of harmonies you're going to use, what kind of arrangement there's going to be. Yeah. Is that your job to figure that out, or is that the producer's job?
It's mostly ours.
We work with the vocals.
Yeah.
A lot of the musical selection is a lot done by the producer, because so many times I don't feel confident in saying I know this is a hit, because it does change, you know. Things change from time to time. So you do rely on the producer for direction, but the harmonies and the singing, you know, we usually handle that ourselves.
The albums that you do now have, I think, overdubbing in them. There's different tracks laid down. And you were telling me before that when you started recording, it was mostly not necessarily a one take thing, but mm-hmm. but a song was done whole straight through without things being laid over mm-hmm. after the fact. What's the difference for you as performers between those two ways of doing an album?
It's not that different because we don't do a whole lot of
overdubbing.
Yeah,
we still don't do a whole lot of overdubbing.
And most things that we put like as an overdub, we make sure that we can do the same thing in a live performance. Mm-hmm. And our producer is really great about that. He likes for us to be able to be singing the background, if we're supposed to, as well as the lead mm-hmm. on the tracks, so we can do it live, and mm-hmm. that's what we do.
What about the instruments? Are they there when you're recording? Are you singing after they've already done their
They're
track?
There usually the first couple of times in the studio for the rhythm dates, to get the track down, the music. And we sing with them, and we usually come back and do the vocals later, but it's something magic about being there with the musicians. We always end up keeping a lot of that first vocal.
Do you feel that the recording process has changed a lot since you started recording?
Not that much to me. It hasn't. Mm-hmm.
What about the music industry and how records are distributed and how it's determined whether something's going to get on the radio or not? Do you notice much of a change with that?
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's changed.
They have a lot of payola going around.
It's tougher now.
It's a big business now. Yeah. Not fun and money anymore. It's business
serious,
and money.
It's big business.
Yeah. Really.
You have to know what... You have to read those contracts.
Really? You got
to
really
know the marketing and, you know, where the records are being played, what they're being sold for, the distribution and everything.
If you want your company to really be behind you and to make sure that you're getting access to the airwaves, what are some of the things you have to watch out for in a contract?
If you want to make sure your records are being played?
If you want to make sure that your company's behind you and that they're going to do their part in getting...
Oh, you just make sure that their name is on there.
Right.
On the contract, for one thing.
You enter certain clauses that may not be in there when they wrote it up for you.
Yeah, you can add your own protection.
You can say, I want this, because they're asking for this and that. And you know, you go through attorneys and...
negotiations.
There are certain guarantees, you know, that you have to ask for.
Yeah. There are certain standards for contracts, so many years and...
You probably heard your records played in a lot of different places in different parts of the world. What are some of the instances that have really surprised you when you've been someplace and suddenly your records come on, either on the radio or in a jukebox or maybe something you've written on the Muzak?
Mm-hmm. Oh, the airplane was a trip one day. I was
right on the airplane.
And then I heard, God, fire. Oh, no. You know, it's like, wow. And then they did a little, you know, it was like.
What a maze. Amazed me too is things like getting the royalty statements back and seeing that your records are playing in places that you've
Belgium
never been.
Belgium and really.
Spain and you know, places that we haven't seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. How do musical trends affect you, whether it's disco or new wave?
I love it.
Really, it's always a new challenge.
Yeah,
you know, because it's well, we have a reputation for being versatile anyway, and thinking or knowing we can sing anything, and we take the challenge to do just that. And when the new things come out, we try them. And I don't like to get caught in any one of them, but we like trying them just to mm-hmm. let people know nothing will put us out of style.
Good music and something that'll make you feel good can be in any form or any area.
Yeah,
you know?
As long as it has a funky beat.
Ruth, you have 3 children, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
And either of...
I have one.
You have one. Is it hard to be a mother and to be on the road, too?
It's hard to be a mother.
Period.
I love being on the road. I miss my kids a lot. I have 2 teenagers and a 2-year-old. And... I miss them, but I'm not the ordinary, conventional, all-American mother that wears an apron and cooks and says goodbye to their husband and all this kind of stuff. I just sort of take life one day at a time and try to have fun with my kids and take care of them best I can.
Have they ever toured with you?
Not really toured with me. I'd love for them to, but not all together. I'd like to take them one at a time so that I can concentrate on that one. Really, I would love to take them on the road, but only one at a time.
Is it hard to have a personal life and a life on the road at the same time?
No, not for me.
She's married. And her husband travels with her.
Oh, well.
She's a lucky girl.
Yeah, she is lucky.
Yeah.
What's in your near future?
Looking this is crystal ball.
Oh, we're going to probably music, make another record,
mm-hmm.
you know, next year, the end of this year or something. We want to go back in the studio
mm-hmm.
and do some tours and whatnot.
More writing, more recording.
And we're all going to get into some individual things, too. We're working mm-hmm. on an individual album for June, doing some writing. That'll probably come out sometime next year. And that's going to be real exciting.
This is June the Sister.
June the Sister. Not June the Man.
Right. And Anita and I will probably follow suit one way or another.
Is that so you have more room to stretch out in your own
yeah.
style?
More room to stretch out and not so much dependency on one organization, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck to all of you. I'd like to play something from your most recent record, which is called Special Things. And we're going to hear He's So Shy from it. Do you want to say anything about this recording before we hear?
Oh, this Tom Snow's an excellent songwriter, and I love the song.
Right.
I love the performance.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is the Pointer Sisters from their new record, and the Pointer Sisters are in Philadelphia now. They're performing in the Burgundy Room in the Fairmont Hotel. And I thank you, all three of you, for being here this afternoon and for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Never.
The Pointer Sisters recording of He's So Shy. It's 20 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY FM in Philadelphia. There is a long history of sister groups in music, and certainly one of the most famous of the sister groups is the Boswell Sisters. So we're going to listen now to a 1932 recording of the Boswell Sisters, and this is called Down Among the Sheltering Palms.
I'll be there, honey, wait for me, oh, you darling, down among the sheltering palms. Down among the sheltering palms, honey, wait for me, honey, wait for me, keep waiting for me, need me. Down by the old Golden Gate, out where the sun goes down about 8.
How my love is burning, burning, burning. How my heart is yearning, yearning, yearning to be down
among the sheltering palms, honey, wait.
Thank you.
Another sisters recording team. That was the Duncan Sisters, and the song that we heard was featured in the 1929 MGM film called It's a Great Life. It's now 14 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. 42nd Street, the lavish $2 million musical based on the 1930s Busby Berkeley film, opened recently on Broadway. Michael Stewart co-authored the show along with Mark Bramble. Stewart is a veteran writer for the musical stage. He wrote the books for Bye Bye Birdie, Carnival, Hello Dolly, George M., Mac and Mabel, The Grand Tour, and I Love My Wife, as well as the lyrics for the current Broadway hit Barnum. NPR's Jay Kernis talked to Stewart a few weeks ago when the show was still in its pre-Broadway tryout in Washington, and he found him hard at work photocopying script changes.
Oh, well, you know, when you're on we're a musical on the road. A musical on the road, where if you're 5 weeks, you change for 5 weeks. If you're 5 years, you change for 5 years. And that's exactly what I was doing. I haven't got the patience to wait. So I went down the Xerox machine with the changes and did it myself, because you have to go find a stage manager. Not that they're not terrific. They are. I went and did it myself.
These were changes from last night's notes?
Exactly. There were changes the day before, which reflected the opening. Last night's notes reflected a new set of changes. We get up early in the morning, and we work on them.
This means each morning you get up and you know, well, today I've got to write something funny, and...
That's absolutely right. Every day, you know, you have a set of tasks. It's never an empty day when you're on the road, because... A musical is an enormous undertaking. It's a huge collaboration. Everybody has input. And a lot of things you thought were going to work don't, so you have to change them, and you just keep doing it day after day after day until you're bleary and you can't see anymore. Then thank God it opens and you can go home.
It sounds as if you can be clever on demand.
I don't know if it's exactly that. I tell you, you pick up a certain facility. I've been around for 20 years since Bye Bye Birdie, so I know kind of what I'm doing.
The great line, kid,
You're going out there a youngster, but you've got to come back a star. That is a great line that is from the picture. I don't know if it's from the book, too. I get bleary. I don't remember. What we've tried to do is keep the essence of both the book and the movie, do something new, and still give to the people what they want when they see the name 42nd Street.
Come and meet those dancing feet on the avenue I'm taking you to, 42nd Street. Here's a beat. Okay.